Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Baroness Carolyn Cox is a member of the House of Lords and she's founded a charity called Heart. Heart operates around the world and here in our region, Australian Heart has a project going in Timor-Leste, just to our northern border and one of our more troubled relationships at the moment. In the House of Lords, Baroness Cox has a bill pending on the issue of Sharia law. As you know, that's a system of Islamic law, which she says is causing conditions that the suffragettes would blanch at amongst Islamic women. Welcome to Open House.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
Let's talk about the Baroness thing first. I mean, that's your title. I should call you Baroness Cox, but you've asked me to call you Carolyn, which I shall. How do you get to be a Baroness? It's not something that we do a lot of here in the colonies.
Absolutely. Understood. Caroline is my Christian name, and I always say that I'm a nurse and a social scientist by intention. Hmm. That's what I thought I was doing with my life, a baroness by astonishment. I was wasn't born a baroness. You become a baroness by being appointed to the House of Lords, which is the equivalent of your Senate. Yes. And I was so much not in that world, I was the first baroness I'd ever met. Didn't move in those circles. You wake up one morning, find a baroness looking yourself out of the bathroom mirror. It's quite a shock, but obviously a huge privilege. So I asked God how to use this privilege of being able to speak in one of the houses of the British Parliament, and I think the message came very clearly. It's a wonderful place to be a voice for those who don't have a voice or for people who have voices, but they're not heard. No, that's how I use my role as a baroness.
But you've got this mixture in the House of Lords. It's partially appointed, partially elected. That's something we haven't done here in this country for some time. I mean, we used to. It used to be exactly like that. So what's the process by which you get appointed, and effectively, who do you represent?
Well, you get appointed, I think, there's a nominations committee, and then the Prime Minister, in my case, Margaret Thatcher, endorsed it. But it's the Queen who ultimately awards the peerage. But, of course, that is very much on recommendation of the committee. So you are appointed. People sometimes think it's not very democratic having a non-elected House of Parliament. It's justified, I think, and the more I work there, the more I think it is justified. If you argue teleologically, in other words, back from the purpose to the structure, the purpose of the House of Lords is, the old-fashioned terminology, to be a refining and revising chamber,
House
to make
review.
Sure law is good law. And therefore you get experts in the House of Lords, people who never stand for election, for example, chiefs of defence staff, former ambassadors, presidents of universities, experts in agriculture or pensions. You get a level of expertise in there from people who would never stand for election. And when legislation is going through Parliament, it gets a much more detailed scrutiny in the House of Lords than the House of Commons, where people are busy representing their constituencies and so on. So at its best, the House of Lords actually is a very important part of the legislative process.
Now, in your case, nursing and social science in your background, and speaking for people who don't otherwise have a voice, who are those people for whom you speak?
Well, I set up my small little not-for-profit called Heart Humanitarian Aid Relief Trust, and I'm delighted there is a branch of Heart, Australasia, here. And I established that really for two purposes, to fill a couple of gaps. First of all, we work for victims of oppression and persecution who are suffering at the hands of oppressive regimes, very often in war zones or post-conflict zones. And the big aid organisations, the names we all know, like the UNHCR, UNICEF, Save the Children, can only go places with permission of a sovereign government. If a sovereign government doesn't give them permission, they don't go. So those victims are left unreached, unhelped, unheard. So I have to confess, I do spend quite a bit of my time crossing borders illegally and quite shamelessly to reach those unreached people. And of course, they need aid. We're very small, but we work with local partners. And the local partners are amazing mustard seed people. They're very resourceful, very resilient, and they take the little we give them and they multiply it, working with their local communities in transformational ways. So we try to provide aid for those victims and also to be their voice and to ask them how they want their case represented to the world outside. So we do aid and advocacy for victims of oppression and persecution.
Now, this comes out of a place of your own Christian faith, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. The biblical mandate, heal the sick, speak for the oppressed. And I add not just the Christian oppressed and the Christian hungry and naked. the biblical mandate says speak for the oppressed, feed the hungry. Mm. And therefore we work for victims of oppression and persecution, whatever their faith tradition, with unconditional love. In Eastern Burma, we call it Burma, not Myanmar.
Yes.
Our people prefer that.
Yes.
We work, for example, with the Shan people. There's still heavy fighting going on in northern Shan state. We don't hear much about that. We hear about the Rohingya, who are also genuinely suffering. Mm. They get known about, and they need to get known about. But you don't hear about the Shan and the Kachin, where there's still very heavy fighting going on, thousands and thousands of displaced people. So we will work with them. The Shan are predominantly Buddhist, the Kachin are predominantly Christian. Mm. Or in Sudan, we work in, I was across the border illegally in Blue Nile State, where the people have been suffering at the hands of the oppressive jihadist Islamist regime in Khartoum, mm. and they're predominantly Muslim, but they will not go down that extremist terrorist route. And so they're under attack. Mm. And we work for them. I was across the border there early this year. Across 9,000 people have been forced to flee the fighting. We were the only aid organization to be there. No one else had got there at all. And they were dying. They were scavenging for roots. They were boiling leaves with no nutritional value to stop the pangs of hunger and the stomachs. Mm. But there was no one else to help them. When we got back to the UK, we raised £50,000, about 90,000, I think, Australian. And as I understand it, it may not sound very much.
No, I'm laughing at your accent.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for attempting that.
Well, I hope it sounds authentic. But, you know, it may not sound very much money, but £29 UK will feed a family of six for 3 months until the rainy season.
And how do you deliver that then, if you're the only aid agency to get that?
Yeah. Work for the local people. So they are responsible. I mean, one of the things that always humbles me is the enormous resourcefulness and resilience of our partners in terrible situations. Mm. They still smile, they work. And people tend to have a kind of image of aid victims sitting there with open hands, just waiting for you to put some money in. It's not a handout, it's a helping hand, and they do amazing things with the little we give them.
Can you tell me about some of the families that you've met in those circumstances?
Oh, indeed I can. And, for example, I'll tell you about our wonderful partners in northern Nigeria. Mm-hmm. As I think everyone is aware, Nigeria has seen a recent upsurge of killing of Christians, big time. I mean, hundreds have been killed in recent weeks.
Mm. And it's interesting. I've described it on this program as being a little like the oldest story in the book, that it's essentially about a lot of things, but it's about race, it's about tribe, it's about religion. And above all, it's about access to resources, the access to land, and a fight at the moment between those who graze cattle and coming down from the north, and those who own the land, the farmers, the Christian farmers.
I mean, sadly, and that's been going on for years,
centuries.
The nomadic herdsmen of Fulani, I mean, they've been doing this from time immemorial, but it hasn't been military, it hasn't been aggressive against the Christians. That has changed recently, and that's a very serious development.
Extremism has been able to infiltrate that.
Well, we're afraid, it's been that the Fulani are now being armed and trained.
Yes.
And fulfilling that agenda.
Yes.
You asked me to tell about your family.
Please.
I mean, I'd love to tell you about Archbishop Ben Quashy, the Anglican Archbishop of Dross, and his wife Gloria. They're partners of heart. They have a wonderful Christian institute, and they do a lot of work with schools and so on. But very poignant story. His wife Gloria, lovely, lovely lady, but some years ago, militants went to kill the bishop. He was then. He wasn't there, so they took his lovely wife, Gloria. They did horrible things to her. They gang-raped her, violated her with broken glass and splintered wood. They trampled on her so hard she lost her sight. Obviously, the bishop went back immediately, and I received one of the most moving emails I've ever received. Mm. He said, "I've now been back for 24 hours. I've had time to sit and think and pray. And then here's your African resilience coming out." He said, and I had a laugh, because I remembered when I was a little boy, my mum used to pray so hard that I'd be a Christian. And I know that when we people in Nigeria get into trouble, Christians of West pray for us, and it's good for Christians of West to have to pray, so maybe we should get into trouble more often. Then he turned serious. He said, "I've just come from the hospital. My beloved Gloria was able to sit to receive Holy Communion. We had a wonderful time of prayer and worship together. We praised God. We've been found worthy to suffer for his kingdom. And we just prayed that all of Gloria's pain, anguish, and humiliation would be used for his kingdom and his glory." To praise God for that suffering? Mm. That's the kind of courage we find on the front lines of faith and freedom. Mm. And very often when the churches worship in countries like Nigeria, Sudan, they worship with more joy than in many a comfortable church in comfortable Christianity in the West.
Well, I've no doubt that's true. Our guest on Open House is Baroness Cox, the Baroness of Queensbury, no less, and Chief Executive of the Humanitarian Aid Relief Trust, or HART. And you mentioned that HART operates here in Australia, and you've just been with the Australian people, some of whom are sitting in this studio. You've just been to East Timor, Timor-Leste, a country with which Australia has an interesting, complex relationship, I feel quite sure. What did you find in Timor-Leste?
Well, certainly an improvement when we first went there. When we first went there, went with Dr. Martin Panter, who's sitting here in the studio and helped set up HART Australasia.
He's very quiet.
And so is
Roger Chilton.
Yes, he chairs HART Australasia.
He does.
Uncharacteristically quiet, I might say. But we went first in the early days when there were still hundreds of people living in tents, internally displaced people, and Dili was just a state of almost rubble. Now it is a very different place, but there are still real problems. And amongst the real problems are childhood malnutrition. It's amongst the three worst countries in the world for childhood malnutrition. 50% of children are malnourished. Many suffer stunting, which is the stunting of both physical and mental capacity.
Did you say the worst country in the world for malnutrition?
One of the three. That's very often due to cultural beliefs and sort of suspicions. And it's very sad that traditional beliefs, and in remote areas, the culture persists. And there is all sorts of taboos about eating various kinds of food, which cause malnourishment, and also very high birth rates. You know, a mother may have babies almost every year, then of course she doesn't have enough breast milk, and so there's all sorts of reasons why that malnutrition is there in remote areas particularly. HART UK supports Higham Health, and HART Australia has also supported that, which at the moment has been sponsored by the government to train agricultural extension workers to go out to remote areas and help deal with those cultural taboos and help promote good malnutrition. And HART Australia also has a very good program, Maluk Timor, which is helping to deal with these issues with spaced births. Up to the women to decide how and when they want, but at least give them the option of choice with regard to spacing their births, which helps deal with that malnutrition, and helping to deal with health education and understanding the issues that are so important to reduce the health problems.
Yes, we have the great blessing of education in the Western world, which is maybe the defining difference between haves and have-nots, because once you know, then you can make choices. The freedom to make a choice is important, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yes.
But you have to know. Yes. It has to be informed choice. And that's what HART Australasia is helping with in Timor-Leste.
Yes. Our guest is Baroness Carolyn Cox. She's a member of the House of Lords, a life peer, and the head of a charity that she's established called HART. You've also been notable in the UK for speaking up for women in Islamic communities, a controversial area, no doubt. And just this week, Boris Johnson, your former foreign minister, has been getting himself into trouble with the Prime Minister over what I think were actually offensive comments regarding how women who wear burqas look. Did you think they were offensive comments?
Yes, I do. I think there is a real issue there, but you have to deal with these issues sensitively.
Yes.
I am worried about the widespread use of the burqa for various reasons. One is it actually prevents real communication. It helps prevent, I think, integration, and it can be a genuine security risk. But there are ways of talking about those issues which must be sensitive and not aggressive. And I think Boris Johnson, unfortunately, was really quite offensive.
Well, the Prime Minister ticked him off for that, and she said at the end of the day it would be the matter a matter for choice, the choice of the woman herself, whether she wears a burqa. And I reckon that most reasonable people in this country would say something similar. We're pretty open as a society about that. I understand from previous discussions with you that you're concerned about women who don't have a choice.
Yes, in Britain we have widespread application of Sharia law. We have over 80 Sharia councils or courts. And I believe in freedom of religion and belief. I believe that there are aspects of Sharia law that are not a problem. For example, fasting in Ramadan, Christians fast in Lent, praying five times a day, possibly more than many Christians pray, including me.
Yep.
So there are problems, I mean, there are issues in Sharia law which are not problems, but there are real problems, and particularly for women. The application of Sharia law, for example, a man can divorce his wife just by saying, I divorced you three times, and the wife is divorced, unless she has a legally registered marriage, and most do not. Muslim women come to see me, and we weep together. I mean, they are really desperate. So there is the problem of the asymmetrical divorce. They're left destitute and with no rights. There's the problem of polygamy. In Sharia law, a man can marry four wives. In Britain, we don't allow bigamy, but when their marriages are not legally registered, polygamy is very widespread indeed. Mm. Women may find themselves being married third wife into a marriage of four women, and they're not very happy about that. Mm. Some are desperately unhappy. The so-called honour-based violence, so-called honour-based abuse. Mm. And that, again, women are really desperate. I always say they suffer in some of those communities in ways that would make our suffragettes turn in their graves. And I'll just give you a couple of very quick examples. A lady came to see me not so very long ago, and she was suicidal. She'd been divorced by her husband. She had no rights at all. She went to, and very often if they want to go to the Sharia Council for help, they have to pay. They don't have money. So they're desperate, they're caught. If they do go, in this case she did, and the imam actually denied the marriage had taken place. And she got a video of it, that it was not recognised at all. She was destitute, she was suicidal, and her husband then began bad-mouthing her in the community, saying she was broken glass and that she was unfaithful. He was doing this both in her community in Britain, but also her community back home in Pakistan. So she said, I've got no way forward. With that dreadful reputation my husband's given me, I'll never be able to get another good marriage. I am destitute, I'm alone, I'm suicidal. Yeah. Or just one other example, a colleague of mine who is actually an obstetrician, a 63-year-old man, brought his 23-year-old wife to have a repair of hymen, which is an illegal operation, unless it's clinical reasons. Yeah. So my colleague asked the husband why he wanted this done. He said, I want to take my wife back to Pakistan, marry her to another man, he'll get a visa to come to Britain, and I get £10,000 for doing this. And my colleague said, well, you know, it's an illegal operation. I can't do it. He said, it's being done all the time down the road. So these are serious issues, and women are really suffering.
Yeah.
And my basic principle is have, by all means, whatever kind of legal system that a group may want, provided it doesn't violate the fundamental laws, values, principles, and policies of our nation. And that's where you have to draw the line.
On this question of Sharia law, so let's be clear about it. You're saying that Sharia councils exist. Sharia law exists because it's practiced by people. It's observed by observance, adherence, but it's not a legal system within the framework of the United Kingdom. And I don't think there's anyone credible, you know, suggesting that it be any other way. So sometimes the argument about Sharia law, I think, is misunderstood or misused, that Islam is trying to take over our democratic institutions. And it's not happening that way here. So what you've observed may be happening in lots of communities, traditional communities, if you will. And isn't it like the discussion we just had about Timor-Leste, that the antidote to that is education and choice, and those women have democratic legal rights in your country as they do in ours, and the law ought to and would protect them if only they could access it?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. First of all, there is a real need to enable these women to understand their rights.
That's it, yes, exactly.
And that is crucial, and it doesn't happen in many of these communities. They're very closed communities. But even if they understand their rights, if it is a Sharia law area where Sharia law is applied in the Sharia councils, then that does allow the asymmetrical divorce. The man can just say, I divorced you three times. One lady came to see me. She received a divorce through the post, and she was desperate. And she went to the imam, and he said, yes, you are divorced. Now, that shouldn't happen in a country like Britain. So my private member's bill I have in Parliament at the moment is an attempt supported by Muslim Women, Muslim Women's Advisory Council, other Muslim women's groups in the UK, is to make it a requirement that all religious marriages should be legally registered. And then that would help to deal with this issue of the asymmetrical divorce, the polygamy, and so on.
Yes.
But these are very closed communities.
Yes.
And I think we do need to get real and understand that these are real problems, and we have to speak about them. If we don't speak about them, then everyone's afraid of being called Islamophobic.
Yeah.
And my answer to that is, I'm not Islamophobic. You meet the Muslim women who come to see me, we love each other.
Yes. And now, it's interesting, this is the discussion we had when we were in the United States at a conference together, I recall it, because in the United States, this argument can get really out of shape. But what I like about your approach is that you're dealing with it from the perspective of human rights rather than, what borders sometimes on hatred and religious bigotry, the sort of thing Boris Johnson was doing the other day, or, can I say it, our Pauline Hanson, a senator, wore the burqa into the Senate. It was a stunt, it was an ugly stunt, and it was divisive.
Well, I think God gave me an inspiration in trying to raise these issues. I think he gave me the idea to shine the light through two prisms. One prism is the prism of gender discrimination in a country where we're meant to be promoting gender equality.
Mm.
And the other prism is the threat to that fundamental principle of democracy, of one law for all. In a country which signed Magna Carta 800 years ago.
Yes, thank you for that, by the way.
Yes. it is actually de facto happening. It is a kind of parallel legal system.
That's really interesting.
So these are issues that we really do need to address.
Mm.
Increasingly raising it in the House of Lords, I get a huge amount of support. The last debate we had on it, there were 19 members of the House of Lords who spoke in favour of the issues that I've raised, and they range from top Conservatives, Lord Mackay of Clashfern, a former Lord Chancellor, a Christian on the Conservative side, on the Labour side, Baroness Donoghue, who used to head up our conciliation service, on the Liberal Democrat side, Lord Dulacre, who's a Hindu, and also a brave Muslim lady spoke on the Liberal Democrat side, on the crossbenches, Independents, where I sit, Alex Carlisle, one of our leading law lords, leading judge, and Lord Green, a former British ambassador to Saudi Arabia and Syria, who's seen it in practice.
Mm-hmm.
So raising awareness is really important.
What happens to you, Bill? What goes? When do you think it'll go to a vote?
Well,
do you only get one? They used to get one morning a week for private members' business in the parliament that I was a member of, and it never progressed.
No, I didn't expect the government to take on the bill, but we get a good debate on it, and that raises awareness and gets the issues out and puts pressure on the government.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's what's really important, to try and call government to account. And Theresa May, our present Prime Minister, when she was Home Secretary, made a very powerful speech about the problems Muslim women suffer under Sharia law in the UK. And it was a very strong speech. And she said she would set up a review to look at the way Sharia law operates in the UK. Mm. She then became Prime Minister. The Sharia law review was set up, and everyone's very worried because it consists almost predominantly of imams and Islamic scholars.
Mm.
So people were worried that it would just move ahead in the direction we didn't want, sort of enshrining Sharia law. They've recently reported, and I'm happy to say that the first two recommendations of the Sharia law review are entirely compatible with my private member's bill, that in their case it's Islamic marriages, mine is all religious marriages,
yes, yes,
but should be legally registered, and there should be the raising of awareness of the rights of women in those communities and the implications of their situation.
Their democratic rights, just as we've agreed.
Mm. Well, so my pressure on the government is, what are they going to do and when they're going to act on this?
Great questions. I can't close the interview without asking you this, or maybe even just observing it. Brexit's a mess, isn't it?
Sadly, yes. I put my colours right out on the mast. I'm a leaver. I believe in Brexit because I want to regain our sovereignty and I want to regain political accountability. So I am a Brexit supporter. But the whole situation as it has developed is immensely divisive. And I think at the moment very destructive in the way total preoccupation with Brexit and a lot of other important issues are getting sidelined.
Oh, yeah, well, we know a little bit about that here. And will Boris Johnson become the Prime Minister?
I have no idea, but I have to say I wouldn't vote for him.
Great answer. Well, Baroness Cox, it's been delightful catching up with you. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you very much for having me and letting me share some of the deep concerns.
Yes, Baroness Carolyn Cox, the Baroness of Queensbury, a member of the House of Lords, a life peer, and the founder of HART, H-A-R-T, which stands for Humanitarian and Relief Trust. which was started in 2004 to relieve suffering, oppression and persecution of people who are largely neglected by international media. Now, if you'd like to find out more about Heart Australasia, they have a website, HART-Australasia.org, HART-Australasia.org. I'm sure if you Google Heart and Baroness Cox, you'll be able to come across that there as well.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.